now convinced, more than likely, this is a blood semen mixture.
We didn't know what this DNA was all about. I knew nothing of it, I had heard of it.
This was very new technology. This was one of our very first cases.
Enter the world of forensic science, the science of crime, where a suspect's guilt or innocence can hang on a single piece of evidence. Today, DNA analysis is accepted as the forensic tool of the 21st century. But let me take you back to a time before DNA was a science accepted in court. Let me take you back to the year 1990, to a Sunday morning in mid-October. Alice Keating was 6 years old, the only child of divorced parents. Her mother, Grace, was on welfare and struggled to make ends meet. At 7:30 on that Sunday morning, Alice watched cartoons with her mother's new boyfriend. Even though she'd known him less than 2 months, she called him Dad. But things weren't always that smooth between Grace and her boyfriend. At 9 a.m., Alice told her mother she was going out to play. She was allowed to be on her own, but only in and around the building. A neighbor remembered seeing Alice playing at 9:30. When she didn't return for lunch at 11:30, her mother became worried. As time passed, Grace became frantic. At 1 o'clock, when there was no sign of Alice, Grace Keating reported her missing to the police.
You've got to stay as professional as you can, and you've got to shut off your emotional ties to the case. It's harder to do in some cases than others, and these types certainly are the hardest to do. It may sound cold to some people, it probably is cold, but if you don't do that, the case is going to flounder.
She told police that Alice was an obedient child who'd never wandered off on her own. Grace's theory was that some deranged childless woman had kidnapped the most beautiful little girl in the world, her Alice. Local police mounted what is known as a full-scale Phase 3 search. They put 77 officers into the hunt, a canine unit, a helicopter, and an infrared scope, and hundreds of civilian volunteers. They scoured the neighborhood around Alice's building and looked behind every bush in the valley north of the apartment building. They even checked nearby sewers. The six-year-old seemed to have vanished into thin air. Grace retreated to her apartment. She wasn't waiting for the phone to ring. Her phone had been turned off months earlier because she couldn't afford to pay her bill. One of the first suspects was Grace herself. A neighbor reported seeing a man and a woman arguing outside the building the night before and driving off with a child in a blue van.
This was the premise that the first police officers were dealing with at the time that they met the mother, and they felt initially that the mother wasn't being truthful with them, and that something had happened in the early morning hours that really resulted in the child being missing.
an excruciating 24 hours, Grace was cleared when police learned it was a completely different family in the blue van. Meanwhile, the search continued day after day. After 7 days, police informed Grace that they were calling off the search. Grace had never felt so helpless. The police had searched every apartment and all 5 floors, 5 times. But technically, the building had 6 floors. There was a boiler room on the roof. 2 days after the search had been called off, an electrical inspector came upon Alice Keating's body, partially hidden behind one of the boilers.
The room was poorly ventilated, extremely warm, and as happens in these types of conditions, the body had begun to decompose, and at the time of its discovery, was in an advanced stage of decomposition.
It was one of the most difficult autopsies the pathologist had ever performed.
Evidence of a sexual component in this case included a massive laceration of the vagina. This was of a very gross nature and would certainly qualify as a brutal sexual assault associated with, in my opinion, the asphyxiation of this child.
With no eyewitness to Alice's abduction and murder, the case would hinge on minute evidence found at the scene of the crime. Using a ladder so as not to contaminate the floor of the boiler room, the forensic ident squad collected hairs and fibers one by one.
It's what we call associative evidence. That is, we try to link people with each other, people with objects, or objects with objects, by the association of trace matters such as hairs and particularly fibers.
Then the ident officers found something else. A small smear on the boiler room floor, something with a liquid content. They didn't know what the smear was, what it contained. This is when Keith Kelder entered the case. He tested the substance for blood.
In an instant, quick reaction, yes. But I suspected blood being present. Looking at it visually, it's now confirmed.
Then Kelder made a second test. Kelder rubbed the paper with a tiny amount of a chemical solution.
The tests for semen. It's an enzymatic reaction, just as the first test is. And because of the reaction being so intense, I'm now convinced, more than likely, this is a blood-semen mixture.
A sample was also sent to the newly created DNA lab at the Center of Forensic Science. Who had raped and murdered 6-year-old Alice Keating? Exhibit A, a tiny smear of blood and semen, held the answer. Homicide investigators interviewed more than 70 people who had access to the boiler room. But in the end, they narrowed the list down to 4 prime suspects. Suspect 1 was Reggie Warner, the building's assistant superintendent. Police learned he'd had an affair with Grace Keating, Alice's mother. That got their attention. So did the fresh cut across the top of Warner's nose. The second suspect, Fred Linus, was an assistant janitor in the building. Number 3 was the youngest suspect, 19-year-old Johnny Tercera. He was a part-time janitor at the building and had been assigned to work the Sunday morning Alice vanished. Then there was a fourth suspect, Grace's boyfriend, Wayne Sorensen. In the 2 months they'd been together, police had been called to intervene in their domestic disputes more than once. All four had alibis as to their whereabouts between 9:30 and 11 that Sunday morning. Reggie Warner claimed he'd gotten the cut on his nose in a barroom fight on the Saturday night. That's why Sunday he'd spent watching TV and doing chores around his house. Fred Lyonnais insisted that Saturday night and Sunday morning he'd been out of town at a motel. Johnny Tercera admitted he'd overdone booze and grass that Saturday night and had been so sick Sunday morning, he'd come into work at 8:30 and left less than an hour later. Wayne Sorensen maintained he'd been with Grace Keating the whole time. As investigators checked out their alibis, they wanted something else from the four suspects. Samples of scalp hair. Samples of pubic hair. Samples of saliva and samples of blood were taken from each of the suspects. The samples were taken to the Center of Forensic Science, where the forensic team would begin a painstaking process of analysis.
Anytime we're examining either hairs or fibers, it's obviously very easy to say something is different, and therefore we can eliminate it. However, when we find similarities, it may require very extensive testing to determine by a battery of tests whether there are, in fact, still similar at the end of the day.
Crocker was trying to match hairs collected from the suspects with torso hairs collected on the floor of the boiler room. At the time of this case, the early 90s, the ABO system was still the standard for analyzing blood. There were four blood types, type A, type B, type O, and type AB. In about 20% of the population, blood types could also be ascertained through bodily secretions, such as saliva and semen. Kelder determined from Alice's medical records that she was type O, and that the blood in the smear on the boiler room floor was type O. This meant that the semen in the mixture came from a man who was type O and a secretor. Despite tremendous odds, Kelder also examined the victim's clothes for semen.
It was extremely important to establish that semen is not only present at the scene on the floor, not far from the body, but also present on the clothing. And so that too had to be vigorously pursued. And even though someone might say, you're not going to find anything on here, it's impossible. How, after this length of time, and yet we pursued it, and yet we got a positive reaction, and yet we found a spermatozoa. And no, it was not sufficient for ABO typing. I mean, it's something far more discriminating, and DNA fit the bill.
Pam Newell would try to compare the DNA from the four suspects with the DNA on Alice Keating's clothes and the DNA from the blood semen mixture in the boiler room.
The interesting thing about the DNA molecule is that 99.9% of all of our DNA is the same. And it's what I call, when I'm talking to a jury, housekeeping DNA. It's the DNA that makes a human being as opposed to an orange peel. So it's DNA that says put a head on the top, two eyes, two ears, a nose, fingernails, toenails, functioning heart, functioning liver. We're not interested in that sort of DNA when we do forensic DNA analysis because we're all the same. It doesn't help us in answering the question, could this sample have come from this person? What we need to look at is that very small proportion of the DNA molecule where there are differences, where we have the ability to distinguish one person from another.
Of course, given that this would be Canada's first major DNA case, the results would have to be presented in a way that a judge and jury would understand and accept. As for Grace Keating, one day was hard to distinguish from the next. The littlest things could set her off. The bigger things were devastating. Her desire for revenge scared her, and the pain of her murdered daughter seemed too big for one heart to contain.
In a case like this, it gets a lot of public attention. There's a great deal of pressure that comes with these cases. You know that somewhere out there is someone who's done probably the most horrendous crime that could be done, and you've got a duty to find them and bring them before the justice system.
While Alice Keating's murderer still walked free, detectives relied on forensics for their next move. Keith Kelder was ready with his results. Whoever had raped and murdered Alice Keating was a type O and a secretor. Reggie Warner was a type B and a non-secretor. Fred Linus was another type B and a non-secretor. Wayne Sorensen was a type A and a non-secretor. Johnny Tercera was a type O and a secretor. The catch was that approximately 15% of all humans are type O and secretors. Jim Crocker's hair and fiber evidence also pointed to Tercera. From Grace Keating, detectives learned that Tercera had once chased away some boys who were picking on Alice. Because of that, Alice told her mother that Tercera was so cool.
We had surveillance on him. Whenever he would leave from an interview with us, that would tend to be kind of a wild night for him. He'd be out on foot through a lot of the drug areas where he'd be using drugs and alcohol.
Despite all of this, they still didn't have enough to arrest Tercera, but they were zeroing in. Hoping he'd confess, investigators told Tercera they had physical evidence he'd been in the boiler room. That's when he changed his story. He confessed, but only to smoking dope in the boiler room.
Initially, he had denied being up in the room at all or knowing anything about the missing child, and he later changed that and said that on the day, or shortly thereafter, I should say, he had seen the body in the boiler room and that he chose not to tell anyone. He was afraid that he would get into trouble for being up there and finding the body.
Gauthier didn't believe him, but in the hands of a skilled defense lawyer, it could easily be argued that of course traces of Johnny Tercera's hair and blood were found in the boiler room. He was the assistant janitor. They were simply there from some other time. To counter this, Keith Kelder did further tests on the blood-semen mixture.
It could be argued in court that the semen was deposited by the suspect at one point by way of masturbation, and the blood just came later and just happened to be deposited on top of it. And I rejected that hypothesis. The blood and semen were mixed together before they arrived on the floor, before they were applied on the floor. The implications of that are very important.
The sample went straight to Pam Newell's DNA lab. Molecular biologists have developed methods of isolating each DNA molecule and cutting it into different lengths in order for it to be measured and compared. These isolated strands of DNA are then mounted on a plate covered with a gel. When an electrical current is applied, the strands start to move. The gel is then photographed using X-rays, and the result looks like a barcode and is called an autorad.
So think to yourself of all of the swimmers being lined up across the top at the beginning of the race. The race starts, they all start moving down the lanes, and when the race stops, they're stopped in that particular point. We were interested particularly in the profile from the semen on the floor. Now, compared to that, we have DNA samples from suspect number one, suspect number two, suspect number three, and a sample from suspect number four. When we compare the profile from the semen on the floor to the profiles from each of these four suspects, we see that we have a match to suspect number three, as defined on this particular film.
Pam Newell generated five such autorads to compare different parts of the DNA from the semen on the floor. Four of those tests matched Johnny Tercera's DNA. The odds of such a match is 1 in 1.7 million. despite these overwhelming odds, Detective Gauthier was still reluctant to arrest Tercera.
We held back the arrest for about a 10 or 14 day period because we didn't know what this DNA was all about. I knew nothing of it. I had heard of it. I didn't know what the tests could show or would show. So we held back until such time as we became educated in what DNA was about.
It was the prosecution's case that on that Sunday morning, Alice was looking for a playmate. Tercera came along. At his trial, Tercera's mother swore that Johnny arrived home at 11 a.m., making it impossible for him to have committed the murder. The defense grilled Grace Keating about her finances, her drinking, her sex habits. They exposed every fear and doubt she had about being a good mother, anything to shift the blame away from Johnny Tercera. Then Pam Newell was called to the stand.
This was one of our very first cases, and it was with my heart in my throat that I went into the witness box to give these answers, because we all very much wanted to present the technology in the way in which it should be presented, to give it its fair weight, to present it in an objective and accurate fashion.
She was grilled for 14 days. Ultimately, the jury chose to believe the evidence of her silent witness, a strand of DNA. Johnny Tercera was convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to life. When you lose a child through murder, you fall into a deep black hole of bitterness and depression. If you're lucky, lucky enough to have the right support at the right time, you can slowly climb back up into the light. Grace was not so lucky. She had lost the only bright spot in her life. 6 years after the death of her daughter, Grace Keating committed suicide. The stories on Exhibit A are based on actual cases. The names of the victims have been changed to protect their identities. The names of the guilty are real.